Chapter 5. That dream was but a moment in a man's life, whose proper business it seemed was to get food, and kill his fellows and beget after the manner of all that belongs to the fellowship of the beasts. About him, hidden from them by the thinnest of veils, were the untouched sources of power, whose magnitude we scarcely do more than suspect even today, power that could make his every conceivable dream come real. But the feet of the race were in the way of it, though he died blindly unknowing. At last, in the generous levels of warm river valleys, where food is abundant, and life very easy, the emerging human overcoming his earlier jealousies, becoming, as necessity persecuted him less urgently, more social and tolerant and amenable, achieved a larger community. There began a division of labor, certain of the older men specialized in knowledge and direction, a strong man took the fatherly leadership in war, and priest and king began to develop their roles in the opening drama of man's history. The priest's solicitude was seed time and harvest and fertility, and the king ruled peace and war. In 100 river valleys about the warm, temperate zone of the earth there were already towns and temples, a score of thousand years ago. They flourished unrecorded, ignoring the past and unsuspicious of the future, for as yet writing had still to begin. Very slowly did man increase his demand upon the illimitable wealth of power that offered itself on every hand to him. He tamed certain animals, he developed his primordially haphazard agriculture into a ritual, he added first one metal to his resources and then another, until he had copper and tin and iron and lead and gold and silver to supplement his stone, he hewed and carved wood, made pottery, paddled down his river until he came to the sea, discovered the wheel, and made the first roads. But his chief activity for 100 centuries and more was the subjugation of himself and others to larger and larger societies. The history of man is not simply the conquest of external power, it is first the conquest of those distrusts and fiercenesses, that self-concentration and intensity of animalism, that tie his hands from taking his inheritance. The ape in us still resents association. From the dawn of the age of polished stone to the achievement of the peace of the world, man's dealings were chiefly with himself and his fellow man, trading, bargaining, law-making, propitiating, enslaving, conquering, exterminating, and every little instrument in power, he turned at once and always turns to the purposes of this confused elaborate struggle to socialize. To incorporate and comprehend his fellow men into a community of purpose became the last and greatest of his instincts. Already before the last polished phase of the Stone Age was over, he had become a political animal. He made astonishingly far-reaching discoveries within himself, first of counting, and then of writing and making records, and with that his town communities began to stretch out to dominion. In the valleys of the Nile, the Euphrates, and the great Chinese rivers, the first empires and the first written laws had their beginnings. Men specialized for fighting, and rule as soldiers and knights. Later, as ships grew seaworthy, the Mediterranean, which had been a barrier, became a highway, and at last out of a tangle of pirate polities came the great struggle of Carthage and Rome. The history of Europe is the history of the victory and breaking up of the Roman Empire. Every ascendant monarch in Europe up to the last aped Caesar and called himself Kaiser or Tsar or Imperator or Kaiserin Hind. Measured by the duration of human life, it is a vast space of time between that first dynasty in Egypt and the coming of the aeroplane. But by the scale that looks back to the makers of the Eliths, it is all of it a story of yesterday. Now during this period of 200 centuries or more, this period of the warring states, while men's minds were chiefly preoccupied by politics and mutual aggression, their progress in the acquirement of external power was slow, rapid in comparison with the progress of the old Stone Age, but slow in comparison with this new age of systematic discovery in which we live. They did not very greatly alter the weapons and tactics of warfare, the methods of agriculture, seamanship, their knowledge of the habitable globe, or the devices and utensils of domestic life between the days of the early Egyptians and the days when Christopher Columbus was a child. Of course, there were inventions and changes, but there were also retrogressions. Things were found out, and then forgotten again. It was, on the whole, a progress, but it contained no steps. The peasant life was the same. There were already priests and lawyers, and town craftsmen and territorial lords and rulers, doctors, wise women, soldiers, and sailors in Egypt and China and Assyria and southeastern Europe at the beginning of that period, and they were doing much the same things and living much the same life as they were in Europe in A.D. 1500. The English excavators of the year A.D. 1900 could delve into the remains of Babylon and Egypt and disinter legal documents, domestic accounts, and family correspondence that they could read with the completest sympathy. There were great religious and moral changes throughout the period. Empires and republics replaced one another. Italy tried a vast experiment in slavery, and indeed slavery was tried again, and failed, and was still to be tested again, and rejected again in the New World. Christianity and Mohammedanism swept away 1,000 more specialized cults, but essentially these were progressive adaptations of mankind to material conditions that must have seemed fixed forever. The idea of revolutionary changes in the material conditions of life would have been entirely strange to human thought through all that time. Yet the dreamer, the storyteller, was there still, waiting for his opportunity amidst the busy preoccupations, the comings and goings, the wars and processions, the castle building and cathedral building, the arts and loves, the small diplomacies and incurable feuds, the crusades and trading journeys of the Middle Ages. He no longer speculated with the untrammeled freedom of the Stone Age savage. Authoritative explanations of everything barred his path, but he speculated with a better brain, sat idle and gazed at circling stars in the sky, and mused upon the coin and crystal in his hand. Whenever there was a certain leisure for thought throughout these times, then men were to be found dissatisfied with the appearances of things, dissatisfied with the assurances of orthodox belief, uneasy with a sense of unread symbols in the world about them, questioning the finality of scholastic wisdom. Through all the ages of history there were men to whom this whisper had come of hidden things about them. They could no longer lead ordinary lives, nor content themselves with the common things of this world once they had heard this voice. And mostly they believed, not only that all this world was as it were a painted curtain before things unguessed at, but that these secrets were power. Hitherto power had come to men by chance, but now there were these seekers seeking among rare, and curious and perplexing objects, sometimes finding some odd utilizable thing, sometimes deceiving themselves with fancied discovery, sometimes pretending to find. The world of every day laughed at these eccentric beings, or found them annoying and ill-treated them, or was seized with fear and made saints, and sorcerers and warlocks of them, or with covetousness, and entertained them hopefully, but for the greater part heeded them not at all. Yet they were of the blood of him who had first dreamt of attacking the mammoth. Every one of them was of his blood and descent. And the thing they sought, all unwittingly, was the snare that will someday catch the sun. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.